London Calling. David here. It's Sunday, August 16th, 2020. It won't be 2020 for very long, though. We're once again going back to 1968. This episode of the Daily London Walks podcast will, like yesterday's episode and indeed Friday's, look at the early history of London Walks. The account is that of Keith Baverstock, the Australian buccaneer, explorer, adventurer, entrepreneur, visionary, who started London Walks, the oldest urban walking tour company in the world, and who in doing so launched what is now a worldwide phenomenon, urban walking tours. Keith has sent us a memoir in chapters. This is chapter 3, part 3. I'll be voicing it, but it's Keith's words. And this is what he has to say in part 3 of this memoir. The East End of London, 50-odd years ago, bears no resemblance to the East End of today. I last walked through it 2 years ago, on my last visit to the UK. Half a century ago, you seldom saw an Asian, African, or non-white face. There were unfamiliar languages, but mainly of Central European origin. Yiddish, of course, was widely spoken, as there was a preponderance of Jewish families still resident in the area, running the rag trade for which the East End was famous. Then there were the East Enders themselves, who had been through the horror of the war, many of them still working at the London docks, already in deep decline. Today, we think of sweatshops in Bangladesh, Vietnam, or China, producing the clothing we wear. In the late 60s, the sweatshops were to be found in the back streets of the East End, in less than sanitary surroundings and with dubious employment records. It was easy for Walks patrons to envision the London of Jack the Ripper, in the back streets off Whitechapel, where one-up, one-down Victorian terraces survived, flanked by run-down warehouses and bomb sites that had still not been built on since the Second World War. Space, light, and air might have been in short supply, but pride was not. I fondly recall the women scrubbing their front steps till they almost shone. And on a Saturday afternoon, you would see the same women dragging their kids along to the local bathhouse for the weekly bath, no doubt scrubbed till they shone. A shilling or so at the public bathhouse would save them boiling pot after pot of water to fill the tin bath in the scullery. No bathrooms in these Victorian terraces. People on the walks, particularly Americans, found it unbelievable that in swinging 60s London, the London of fashionable Knightsbridge, groovy Carnaby Street, thriving Oxford Street, and way out King's Road, Chelsea, people in some parts of the city still had to rely on the public bathhouse. For my pub tours, I normally stopped at Aldgate, or of course did the popular Dockland pubs, but definitely avoided the Whitechapel establishments in those days, the Blind Beggar, Ten Bells, and the White Hart were for locals. No nice restaurants or pub food. A beer and a bag of chips, the latter if you were lucky. And that was that in somewhat austere surroundings. Some establishments still had sawdust floors 50 years ago. The new Blind Beggar, built in 1894, Jack would not have known, but he would definitely have known its predecessor. outside of which William Booth, founder of the Salvation Army, preached his first open-air sermon. In the 1960s and 1970s, it wasn't good works, but nefarious and violent goings-on that attracted and interested people. The gang wars of such as the Crays and Richardsons were front page. One church minister in the East End once proudly pointed out the pew where the Crays occasionally sat and stressed their generosity to the collection plate. In 1966, animosity between the Crays and the Richardsons came to a head when Ronnie Cray took affront at being referred to as a poof by George Cornell, one of the Richardsons' lieutenants. And while George was quietly enjoying a pint one night in the Blind Beggar, Ronnie walked in and shot him at point-blank range. A public house with a tale, but not one in which to linger over a pint with Walk's patrons. Whitechapel and its surrounds were definitely not on the tourist route. Chatting with locals, you would often find that they had never been up west, visited the West End. And of course, there were those from up west who, on their first walk, would admit they'd never been to the East End before. With the pub tours started, I had a few shillings coming in, and they were gaining popularity, especially with colonials on their 2-year working holidays. But there was an opportunity, I felt, from people's comments, for more general walking tours. I could have started with Dickens or Shakespeare, but wanted a walk that no other tour organizer had thought of, and one that would get publicity. Also, a walk that I personally would enjoy doing. I had taken a shine to the East End, and there was one figure associated with the East End that people knew about, Spring-Heeled Jack, better known as Jack the Ripper. And 50 years ago, enough of the streets and buildings he would have known and walked along still survived. Time again to do the knowledge, this time of the East End, chat with locals, remembering that there were still some people who would have been children when Jack was about, visit the London Hospital, who had reports of Jack's deeds and items from his time, and of course, spend hour after hour in libraries, reading. Google was not around. After a few weeks following in Jack's footsteps through the cobbled streets of the East End, I had a tour that 50 years later still attracts thousands of people each year. The Murder Most Foul Jack the Ripper Walk was launched, and from day one would prove to be a success. Also, the media loved it and promoted it. At 5 shillings a head, you couldn't afford advertising in The Times or The Observer, but providing them with fodder for their weekly What to Do in London column would see ripperologists from near and far join me at Whitechapel or Tower Hill tube stations for a tour down east. And that's it from today. Okay, all the best.